The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the Champions League. What a second half from Spurs, the crusading Vertonghen, the sprinting sun and the eyes and forehead of Llorente. At Old Trafford, the bubble has burst for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Is he a fraud or do PSG just have better players? VAR interrupts Ajax at home to Real while a late Porto goal gives them hope in Rome. In the Championship, Leeds are back on top, Declan Rice is English and the Oystons might be on their way from Blackpool. All that and more on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Happy Valentine's Day to the panel. It is Valentine's Day. It's the day of love. So we must have a Norwegian. Lars Sivertsen, hello.
I've never heard that one before, Max. No. Good morning.
Perhaps I should have said we must have a Frenchman. Hello, Philippe. Bonjour, je t'aime. La 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 la.
Steady on. But bonjour all the same.
How
Max.
Are you, Philippe? Are you well?
I'm quite well. I was at Wembley last night. I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Yeah, great game. We'll get on to that in a second. Catherine writes, I love the extra husk in Barry's voice when you get him up early. Just what I want on Valentine's Day.
Well, hello, Catherine.
not sure about the phrasing of that question either.
You're probably right. That was quite a terrifying hello, Barry. But if you could do the whole pod in that voice, I, for one, will be happy.
Okay.
It's late night love songs for your next gig, won't it?
It's Valentine's Day and I actually have a date tonight.
What?
What?
Yes.
Yeah.
With two of my male friends, one of whom is celebrating his birthday. We're going for beer.
Oh, I'm so excited for you.
So it's Barry White, not Barry Glendinning.
Exactly.
The walrus of football.
Who is the walrus of football? Anyway, let's start. We'll get on to Wembley. Let's start at Old Trafford. Manchester United 0, PSG 2. I had a lot of people saying this is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer failing his first proper test, Lars, which seems slightly unfair to me. I feel like he's had some tests already.
Yeah, obviously you have to start with saying there's been a day of mourning in Norway, as you can imagine. The front page of the newspapers were mainly just a small child crying and some dead puffins. And, you know, for parents as well, like, how do you talk to your kids about the fact that Solskjaer has lost the game? Like, it's very traumatic for everyone. I feel like we learned a few things in that game that perhaps we knew already, one of which being that Solskjaer hasn't made United that much better at defending. Which we've seen, I think I've watched most of his games, and they do still concede a lot of chances. Against Fulham and Leicester, you can get away with that. Against Paris Saint-Germain, maybe not. We saw that they're very reliant on Pogba to create things, but then again, we kind of knew that as well. So I think it's what it is he's made a lot of sort of small improvements, made everyone feel better and all of that, but when you come up against a top team against PSG, there are shortcomings of this team that actually can't be fixed in a couple of months.
Because I read some people saying that he was tactically outwitted by Thomas Tuchel, and I sort of felt, well, if you lose your two quick attacking wide men mm-hmm. at half time,
talking about PSG. Oh, sorry.
Well, obviously they'd lost them before the game, Philippe. But you know, if you've lost Martial and Lingard, that changes how you're going to play, right?
Yes, indeed, and perhaps he doesn't quite have the resources, contrary to what we thought, to come up with a plan B. Or plan O for Ole to cope with that. But perhaps people should look at the game a bit differently from PSG's perspective, because there were also loads of questions about Thomas Tuchel, because it very much is the test. The league is not a test. The cups are not tests. What is one is the Champions League. And people thought, well, we're going to see against a team that is flying at the moment in the Premier League, against very quick attackers, against a coach which has got everything going for him at the moment. We're going to see how Tuchel is going to deal with that. And he dealt with it quite brilliantly. And if you look at the reaction in France, of course, well, no dead puffins, no crying children. There's a crying cockerel, basically. And people saying, well, he's found a way to make Paris Saint-Germain play without Cavani, Meunier and Neymar. And he's the maestro. This is the front page of L'Equipe today is the maestro, the conductor, with a picture of Tuchel, like Sir Simon Rattle, and the players who are together on the pitch looking like a string section.
Would you say that's going overboard slightly, Barry?
Just a bit. You know, shut down Pogba by getting Marquinhos to mark him out of the game and sort of do better in midfield than Manchester United did it. it's not rocket science, you know, and it was a tactic and it worked, but on another day it might not have. It was a good win. The better team undoubtedly won the game on the night, but I think that's over-egging it a bit.
And on the tactical note, it was clever of Tuchel to go basically 3-4-3 or however you call it with the wing-backs. It gives United a problem down the flanks. For Manchester United, you get both... If United leave their wingers high, as Solskjaer likes to do, because he likes players to have options going forward, you have a situation where your fullback is up against both the opposing wingback and either Di Maria or Draxler, depending on which side. But if against that sort of a system, what United would want to do is try to exploit the space that will inevitably open up down the flanks. But then it's not great losing both your quick wide players to injury in the first half. Mm. And if we're talking about Solskjaer making mistakes tactically, I guess the only other obvious thing he could have done was, instead of bringing on both Sanchez and Mata, you could have brought on Lukaku up front and pushed Rashford out wide. So
you'd argue that bringing on Sanchez is a mistake in any case.
In any situation, yeah. But if you had moved Rashford out wide, you would have still had some sort of pace to threaten in behind one of the wingbacks anyway, and that could have caused PSG more problems. But you can also understand, given Rashford's form, why you would keep him up front. And if you move him out wide and you still lose, then the headline will be like, blundering idiot moves free scoring forward out wide for no reason at all. Like, they're still gonna, after the fact, you can always find a tactical reason. I do sort of think this was more a case of United's longer shortcomings that it would be unreasonable to expect him to fix in this time anyway.
But from the beginning of the season, people have been aware that one of the weaknesses of PSG was their midfield, the fact that they were far too reliant on Marco Verratti, who is actually the only true midfielder of that particular squad, and who is somebody, obviously, who is often injured, doesn't last much more than 60 minutes. We had another proof of it at Old Trafford. And people thought this is going to be difficult against Pogba and Herrera and Matic, who've been excellent of late. And the fact he deployed Marquinhos in that role, people would say it's out of desperation because he didn't have any other people at his disposal. But on the other hand, Marquinhos, who'd played a couple of games in that position against Liverpool, mm-hmm. hadn't been great in the first game against Liverpool in that position, suddenly he's made perhaps this position his. He's found a solution. He was confronted with a very difficult problem in a game that is season-defining or could be season-defining for them. He made quite a bold choice, and this choice worked out perfectly. So you could say it's not rocket science, but it's still a masterstroke.
It's still science.
It's still science.
You correct me if I'm wrong, Philippe. I don't watch PSG every week, but I do try to watch much of the big games, and I don't think I've seen Marquinhos look as much like a proper midfielder as he did. I mean, he initially was played out of position out of desperation because this squad is built in a profoundly stupid way. Yep. But now he's played out of position for so long that he's looking... Yeah, I don't think I've seen him look more like a true midfielder than in this game. Having said that, what would worry United is they started the game with a midfield three, yet they lost the midfield emphatically to an out of position centre half and a half fit Marco Verratti. That's not great news.
Philippe, you mentioned Alexis Sanchez. What do they do with him? Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says, I can't do anything about Alexis Sanchez. When he plays, he needs to find himself because we know there's a quality player there.
Well, there is clearly a quality player there, but we haven't seen him since he moved to Manchester United. I've seen occasional flashes, but his performance was so bad against PSG that United might as well have just had 10 men on the pitch.
And a golden retriever.
I don't know what's wrong with him. I suspect there's probably something going on behind the scenes that we're not aware of. Mm. That's something in his personal life. I don't know if it's a relationship breakup or he's lonely. He seems to have quite a solitary, sad existence. You know, and I know footballers have loads of money and nice houses and all that thing, but I wonder if perhaps he just didn't want to go to Manchester United in the first place. But he chose
them over City, right? He had the chance to go to City and he took more money, didn't he?
Well, maybe that was a poor choice that he regrets. I honestly don't know. I can only speculate, but I suspect the reasons are not footballing reasons. Also, he appears to be unpopular. He was unpopular in the dressing room at Arsenal and he seems to be unpopular in the dressing room at Manchester United. The worse he plays, the more unpopular he's going to get. That probably doesn't help either. But it looks like one of those moves that just isn't going to work out. Where does he go from here?
Yeah, where does he go?
But there is a question, I think, about how much he has left in the tank physically. He's 29. He has played a lot of football in his career. And just as a, I didn't do the numbers here, but shout out to clever stat man Christopher Johansson on Twitter, who looked at this back in January. If you compare him to Mesut Ozil, Mata, Willian, Pedro, sort of players of a similar age, he's played between 100 and 200 more games in his life, Alexis Sanchez, because he's played a lot of international football as well.
And without a break, absolutely.
And he has a very energy-intensive way of playing. Fair point. He's all buzzing around. So it wouldn't be... Even if he's not 34, he's 29, but if his body is starting to slow down a bit, that wouldn't be unprecedented in football history. Now, that, of course, does not mean he's finished, but it might mean that he needs to look at the way he plays and trying to find maybe he can't be that all-action, running around, hassling people. Maybe he needs to find a different way of playing, and that's not an easy thing to do, but there are certainly precedents in terms of players who have managed to do it.
Apparently, Sanchez, producer Jonathan saying, was injured colliding with a linesman as he was warming up. He came on and played, then reported thigh pain after the game. So, that might explain that performance, I guess. Can we talk about Mbappe? Because he is just a joy, isn't he? I mean, there's just something about...
He's quite good, isn't he?
His raw pace is just incredible. And obviously, Usain Bolt has proved that you have to be able to run at the right time, in the right place, in the right direction, and be quite good at kicking a football as well. But
it's the decision making as well.
Yeah.
I think perhaps even more than that. It's also because I'm not sure he's much faster than DeAndre Yedlin, for example, but I wouldn't compare to the two players. And also his incredible accuracy in front of goal. I think if you look at, I looked at the stats in Ligue 1 in terms of how often strikers find the target when they shoot. His accuracy is something like 73 or 74% of his shots are on target, which is very, very, very high. Usually anything above 50, you're talking about a very serious finisher here. And it's not just the speed, it's also the... And various types of speed, because it's speed on a long run carrying the ball. It's also acceleration over the first 5 meters. Is ambidextrous, which of course helps. It's also the clarity of his perception of what is going on around him, and his incredible maturity. He's got everything. He's the he's not the next superstar. He's already one of the world's true football superstars.
It's very interesting because for a while Neymar has been feted as like the next player to end up in the Cristiano Messi bracket, and understandably so, but having Mbappe playing next to him, you see so many interesting differences, and it's bizarre that he seems to be a much more mature player, even though he's basically five, Mbappe, and he doesn't faff about as much. It's always a purpose to everything he does.
It's in the head. I mean, there are interviews somewhere on YouTube, wherever, of Mbappe talking to journalists when he was 12 or 13. And you think, 12 or 13, really? Hmm. And he could be quoting from Latin authors, for all I know. It's quite extraordinary, the capacity that he has of expressing himself, articulating his thoughts, and the calmness that really defines his attitude both on the pitch and off the pitch. It's a guy who is obviously very well looked after and somebody who has a very clear career path ahead of him.
What's his background, Philippe? Family background?
Football, a sport. His father is, I think, I don't want to say anything, but I think his father is of Cameroonian extraction and his mother of Maghrebin extraction. Very, very solid and... pacified family background, and somebody who's been earmarked very, very early on. I think that's one of the things. I remember talking to a scout, a Spanish scout, about Mbappe when he really burst on the scene, and I was asking him, why is it that no other clubs has gone for him beforehand? And they said, well, this guy, we've known about him since he was about 11.
We should mention... Well,
that's the background.
We should mention Paul Pogba getting sent off. He's done that move before where he sort of pushes his leg in. He did it against Dele Alli, and it's actually a bad challenge.
I'm sure he didn't mean it as a bad challenge, but it ends up being it. And I wonder if that's a move he should just maybe take out of his repertoire, because getting sent off when you do it.
And also, UEFA has opened disciplinary proceedings against Manchester United after a bottle was thrown at Angel Di Maria, who had a brilliant game, didn't he, on his return to Old Trafford. He was booed from the outset, cheered when Ashley Young pushed him down. It's quite a dangerous slope there, isn't it, on the side at Old Trafford?
The player who has been used more often than any other by Thomas Tuchel.
Is that
this
right?
Season, yep.
Okay. So is
there any other reason for him being booed apart from the fact that he wasn't that
good? I think
good?
He did an interview where he said at some point, I never really wanted to join Manchester United. It became a sort of pantomime villain. But I mean, I mean, that's exactly the right expression, Philippe. Manchester United's next game against Chelsea in the FA Cup on Monday will be interesting. And we'll look ahead to that in the pod on Monday. Right, at Wembley. Lars, you were there. Philippe, you were there.
Oh, yeah.
I was cheering in the pub. what a second half. At half time, we were on a WhatsApp group. You know, it's not as exciting as the Ireland Footballers WhatsApp group. Not yet, but it could be. But I said at half time, well, Dortmund are better than Spurs. And I thought they really were. And Spurs were superb in the second half, Philippe.
Yeah, they were. Apparently, I mean, Pochettino, after the game, when he did his press conference, people asked him, you know, what exactly happened? What did you tell the players at half time? And he said, I didn't tell them much. He basically had already prepared with his analysts video excerpts from the first half of the things they'd done wrong. And he just went to every single one of them and said, no, not here. You know, placement wrong, move wrong. This is what you should be doing. And obviously, he's got very receptive and intelligent players. Mm-hmm. And they just applied what he said. And hey-ho, presto. And you had an absolutely magnificent performance. And honestly, I would really put it very high up in the performances of English clubs in Europe in the recent past. This was superb. And against a very good team, which I had found quite superb in the first half, Borussia Dortmund. We didn't perhaps see the kind of incredibly scintillating quicksilver interchange that we're used to from Favre's team. We were talking, Lars and I, about what we saw in the first half and with Axel Witsel orchestrating the midfield and how it felt like almost like waves on the beach coming and going. The synchronicity between the movements of this midfield was actually something quite beautiful. If you love football, it was something quite beautiful to watch. And which actually led me to the question, can people looking on the television appreciate what is going on here? Because they might have thought Spurs are huffing and puffing. They were not. Puffing, by the way, is a Norwegian reference. It was not. It was basically the consequence of remarkable organization from Favre's team, which was honestly something to behold. And the way that Pochettino found a way around that with his players and managed yet again to get super performances from players who are not super players, tells you everything you need about his qualities as a manager.
This is the thing. Like, I mean, in terms of Spurs' European victories, maybe the win against Real Madrid was a bigger sort of statement in terms of showing the world that, you know, we belong at this level. But just if you'd have told me at some point that Spurs would beat the team that's top of the Bundesliga 3-0 with four centre halves on the pitch and like Vertonghen playing like, you know, peak Marcello and Juan Foyth running the show at the back and sort of Harry Winks being very good in midfield. If you'd have told me that before the season, I would have probably told you that you need to stop taking so much drugs and, you know, there's therapy available for you. You just say no. But this is where we are.
Vertonghen was incredible yesterday.
But he is a deceptively good footballer, Vertonghen. He's actually on record, whether or not this is true, I'm not sure, but he's on record saying that there was, before he went to Spurs, there was very concrete interest in him from Arsenal, but Arsene Wenger basically wanted to use him in midfield and wanted to turn him into a holding midfielder, and he felt that going to Spurs would suit his sporting ambitions better. And you do wonder when you see him run with the ball and the level of skill he has for a centre-half, which is extraordinary, and the way he hits the ball sometimes, if he had been actually bred as a central midfielder at some earlier point of his career, what a player he could have become then. I mean, that's a really enticing idea.
When he was playing with Ajax, he was playing in midfield and central midfield, and which maybe, you know, and he was actually scoring quite a few goals. I'm looking at his stats. The last two seasons at Ajax, he scored 8 goals and 10 goals. So we're talking about somebody, and not from the penalty spot. So we're talking about somebody who had a genuine impact in midfield.
You mentioned Arsene Wenger. He said of Spurs, he was doing punditry, he said, "Look, I'm an Arsenal fan. It's a bit of a sensitive subject for me. They have generations of young players. They look like the Manchester United generation of Giggs, Scholes, Beckham and Neville." Wow. Comparing them to the class of 92. Is that a step too far, Baz?
I don't think so. Only time will tell, I suppose. I don't think that side will stay together in the way the class of 92 or the core of the class of 92 did. But Pochettino has a quite a small squad, and as long as you buy into his ideas and trust him, he seems to have total faith in his players, and there's a good dynamic going on there. But, you know, he's one of those managers, once you're in his bad books, there's, with a couple of exceptions, there doesn't seem to be any way back. But, yeah, they're a very impressive side, but we can only speculate about whether they're will turn out to be as good as the class of 92, and I don't think we'll ever get to see it, because I don't think many of those players will stay at Spurs. They'll move elsewhere.
I think the problem is more with the manager.
Well, yeah, I personally don't think he'll be there beyond the end of this season, but again, only time will tell.
Pochettino, I'm sure, would disagree if he was here, but, you know, when you see results like this, you do wonder if actually we underestimate the value of having a group of players who stay together for a long time, if we are so focused on transfer sometimes and strengthening. You know, whenever something's wrong with a team, we say, oh, we must improve that position and we must buy that. Maybe because Spurs can't really afford to buy the players they would want, they've been forced to just keep faith in these guys. And they're finding ways of getting performances out of players who perhaps wouldn't even be at the club if they had the resources to do what they really want.
Although it's a cyclical argument, isn't it? Every time Spurs lose, one of us will say, well, they probably should have strengthened. That's, and every time Spurs win, you go, well, it just shows what continuity does.
That's probably true, but they are, in terms of, if you look at teams in world football who are punching above their financial weight and who are overperforming, I mean, Spurs have done so consistently in this period where they haven't been signing the players they wanted to. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, Heung-min Son, what a player. I mean, Danny Taylor saying, look, he's playing officially as a centre forward, but he drifted to both wings and deep. He was four roles in one. I mean, what a stunning footballer.
Yeah, and coming on the back of tiring trip as well to the other end of the world, and for the Asian Cup, well, not exactly the other end of the world, to Abu Dhabi. Well, it feels like the other end of the world in some respects. Mm-hmm. And keeps progressing, and I'm being reminded again and again, he's 26. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Absolutely ridiculous. No, he was again absolutely stupendous. Both in, the energy, but also the quality of the runs is exceptional. I don't know how you can deal with this guy, because he pops in absolutely everywhere. But he doesn't do it in an undisciplined way like Alexis Sanchez does, for example. There is always, you know, a means to an end, and it makes complete sense within the organization of the team. He's a splendid finisher. And again, this thing with Spurs players, when you don't have the big guns or some of the big guns, there's always somebody stepping to the plate. And he was not the only one. No. Because, you know, Llorente has been a bit player for a long time, but he probably scored the goal that might guarantee the passages to the quarterfinals.
His first goal.
Sissoko was absolutely magnificent. Yeah. Yes, he was.
Yes.
He was magnificent, and not just in that kind of burly way. And he protected the ball superbly, created havoc on the right-hand side. So you've got all these players simply playing above themselves for their manager.
Llorente's first ever goal for Spurs as a substitute, which is quite extraordinary when you think about the fact he's always coming off the bench. Pretty much every other goal, apparently, he scored when he started the game. If that's wrong, just take it out, but I definitely heard it. Anyway, well done to Spurs. Their 22nd game in 81 days, so they've been on a great run. Let's pay tribute to Gordon Banks. Passed away overnight on Monday. The news was announced on Tuesday morning. He won FIFA Goalkeeper of the Year 6 times. I mean,
there was some quite stiff competition at the time, yes.
Absolutely right. You know, so not just arguably England's greatest ever goalkeeper, possibly the greatest ever goalkeeper of all time, and not just for that incredible save.
No.
I was on the radio on Tuesday morning, and we spoke to Peter Shilton, who said he was my hero. I spoke to Bob Wilson, who did an amazing tribute. I mean, Bob Wilson's a wonderful guy.
Yes.
Saying that when Banks was at Chesterfield, he would stand behind the goal and watch him at one end, and then walk to the other goal at half time and watch Gordon Banks again. Pelé writing on that save, he came from nowhere. He did something I didn't feel was possible. He pushed my header somehow up and over. I couldn't believe what I saw. Even now when I watch it, I can't believe it. I scored so many goals in my life, but many people, when they meet me, ask me about that save. He was a glorious footballer, Philippe.
Yes, I think it was more than that. And I was reminded of a sketch in The Fast Show Do you remember that sketch? Paul Whitehouse with his mates. It's called Indecisive Dave. And they're trying to name the greatest England, you know, all-time 11. And yes. He goes, Gordon Banks. And everybody nods. And then he starts, and every name he gives, people say, nah, he wasn't that good, and changes his mind immediately. And every time he mentions another player, say, well, okay, let's start again, Banks. And everybody goes, yeah. So there's this thing about him that he's basically how he was. But actually, you see, he is one of England's all-time greats and somebody who everybody agrees about. And not just in England, by the way, because, I mean, growing up, when we were talking goalkeepers, there were two names which came to mind immediately. It was Yashin and Gordon Banks. That was that. And his aura went way, way beyond England. And I think he said for every keeper of the generations which followed him, he was the example to follow. Mm. Just nothing less than that. It's an absolutely huge man.
It's interesting you mentioned the word aura, because last year, I think you were there as well, we were at this Football Writers Association do when he was there, and I thought that was extraordinary. He spoke very well, obviously, but it's a room full of some, I think it's fair to say, some pretty jaded people, like people in our profession. We're very lucky we get to meet some big names and all this, but there's something about when Gordon Banks walks into the room and walks up to the stage, people would just be very quiet and just, oh my God, that's Gordon Banks. Like, I mean, just an incredible character in the British game, really, just in English football history.
Incredibly humble upbringing as well that he had, and loved wherever he played, especially at Stoke City, where there's a statue of him. There were, you know, lots of people going down to that statue on Tuesday morning.
When people die, you read about them in obituaries and stuff, and there's always a few little things you pick up that you might not have otherwise been aware of. And there was two things caught my attention just reading up about Banks, who seems to have been just a lovely bloke, a real gent, but he, at a function somewhere, he was a very keen dancer and did the Love Train with Tony Cascarino.
I've got that here, shall I read it? Oh, I'll read this. It's beautiful. Brilliant from Cascarino.
Yes, the other was, which I was completely unaware of, he made one appearance for St. Patrick's Athletic in Ireland, kept a clean sheet, St. Pat's won, and he saved a penalty from Eamon Dunphy.
Before I read the Cascarino anecdote, because it's brilliant, there's another save that he made from Jeff Hurst in a League Cup semi-final, I think in 72, which is unbelievable. So, I mean, this penalty from Jeff Hurst, it's like an exocet. It's like Stuart Pearce plus Dean Saunders plus Franny Lee. You know, it's the hardest hit penalty you ever see, and how Banks managed to get it over the bar is just extraordinary. I think it's in the last minute of the game. And I remember there was an anecdote someone said that they met Gordon Banks and asked him about that save again, which was an amazing save. And the David Coleman commentary is so evocative. And I think people of my age remember it from Three Lions, the Bedelian Skinner song, because it's in that song. Gordon Banks eventually just said to someone, oh God, I wish that had gone in so people would stop asking me the question. Anyway, here's Cascarino saying, I met Gordon Banks for the first time about 10 years ago. It was Christmas and we danced to Love Train in a hotel in Liverpool. When the sun came on at 7 p.m, I'd been laughing away with my back to the dance floor thinking, wow, it's a bit early for this. And then I felt a gentle tug on my arm. I turned around and there was one of my heroes, a World Cup winner, telling me, jump in, Tony, the Love Train is going. It was all a bit surreal, him holding onto my hips, and we did the Love Train, kicking our legs out to the side on the dance floor at the Littlewoods Christmas party. I don't know if he was a good dancer, as I had my back to him, but he was a safe pair of hands and he held onto my hips tightly. Although he did have a big target to aim at, says Cass. The song ended and I turned round and said, nice to meet you, Gordon. Beautiful story, yes. As you say, Barry, what comes across is that he was a thoroughly wonderful man as well as a brilliant footballer. Other sad news that we've heard this morning about Eric Harrison, the Manchester United youth coach credited with developing their class of 92, has passed away at the age of 81. He played himself at Halifax, Hartlepool, Barrow and Southport before he became Manchester United's youth team manager in 1981. Enjoyed his greatest success after Sir Alex revamped United scouting network after he was appointed manager in 86. Manchester United say they're deeply saddened by the news. I think Gary Neville probably says it best this morning. We've lost our mentor, our coach, and the man who made us. He taught us how to play, how to never give up, how important it was to win your individual battles, and what we needed to do to play for Manchester United Football Club. Eric, we owe you everything. And that'll do for part one. In part two, we will reflect on the other Champions League games that happened in the last couple of days.
It's time to focus.
They rush the baby to the hospital, and that's when they start accusing Imelda. They say, well, you tried to kill your daughter.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. This is a message from Mac, who says, I wonder if Max will express the exact same bewilderment and astonishment at doing a live show at a place called Earth as he has done for the past seven episodes. Point taken, Mac. 15th of March at Earth in Hackney. Me, you, Barry, Greg Bukowski, and mystery guest. Mojo says, I reckon it's Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He's an expert in zonal marking, loves nothing more than criticising man marking during his sermons. So now, Barry, the mystery guest is on the line. Have you got practice your mind-blown noise?
Yes, I have.
Have you got that ready?
Woo!
Okay.
We don't know who it is.
We don't know who it is, and they're on the line now. I've got sort of butterflies, Barry.
I have a horrible feeling it's going to be incredibly underwhelming.
Okay, anyway. Could mystery guest who will be on the live show, could you please introduce yourself with your full name, just in case we don't recognise your voice and then there's a really awkward bit. Away you go.
It's Michael McIntyre. No, it's not. It's David Squires.
Oh my God.
That's marvellous. Do you know what? I actually thought that is
Don't
Michael.
Don't patronise me.
I thought that is Michael McIntyre.
I didn't see that.
Oh, really? That's pretty good.
I wouldn't mind Michael McIntyre sitting there, but I just was looking at Barry's.
I wouldn't have done it.
It's a very strange booking.
What are you doing over here, Squires?
I'm coming over there for
just
for
this.
I wanted to come over before Brexit because my mum and dad are quite twitchy and they're going to start pulling up the floorboards to sell the copper piping and there's some stuff under the floorboards that I need to get hold of before they do. So that's why I'm coming over. But also, to appear on the show, obviously.
Are you as funny and entertaining in real life as you are on drawing cartoons?
No, and that is what's called a low bar.
Will you be sitting there etching during the show, drawing us live?
No, I'm on holiday. I'm not. I'm over there for business reasons, and the flight and accommodation is tax deductible. So, I can do some drawing. I'm sure there's no other reason for me to be there. Let's face it.
Well, we look forward to having you, David. What's the weather like? You don't think
this has been built up a bit too much, do you?
Well, considering I thought it might be Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
I was listening to the podcast on Monday. And I briefly forgot that I was going to be the guest. And when you were speculating about who it might be, I was sort of quite excited myself, thinking, is it going to be like Pele, the Pope? It's me.
Well, David, we are thoroughly excited to have you. And we'll see you on the 15th.
Yes, see you then.
David Squires joins me, Barry, and Greg. Wow. And that'll be fun. Oof. Do you do your ooh noise again, Barry?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised enough to forget to do my ooh noise. It's good. He's not on the list of famous people I've written down.
So I'm just getting to the stage where I was thinking it was going to be, Brad Pitt. I don't know how he'd fit in with Football Weekly. But we give him a go. Brad, if you're listening, you can come along too. Ajax 1, Real Madrid 2. Barry, you watched this, didn't you? I feel so sorry for Ajax. Should I?
A little. they were very impressive, particularly in the first half. Possibly a little naive. They had enough chances to win the game, didn't take them. And Real Madrid, being Real Madrid, sort of mugged them off and made off with the 2-1 win, you know, courtesy of a late smash and grab. It was a good game, and I was very impressed with Ajax, but maybe they were a little bit naive.
Were they unfairly cheated by the VAR?
No. But again, VAR was shown up to be far from perfect. I'll just quickly explain what happened for anyone who didn't see it. Cross in from the right, and Matthijs de Ligt headed goalwards. Thibaut Courtois sort of flapped at the ball a bit, it looped up in the air, and with Courtois caught in no man's land on the edge of his 6-yard box, and Nicolas Tagliafico headed the ball into the net. And as he did so, Dusan Tadic was sort of standing in front of Thibaut Courtois. So the goal was awarded. Real Madrid didn't complain. Someone had a word in the ref's ear. There was a lengthy pause while the VAR team discussed stuff with the referee. He eventually went over to his pitch side monitor to try and figure it out for himself. So he had two decisions to make. First, as Tagliafico headed the ball, was Tadic offside? He was, by millimetres. You know, it was one of those. His toe was offside. Fair enough, you're either offside or you're not. Then the ref had to decide, matter of opinion, obviously, was Dusan Tadic interfering with play, stopping Thibaut Courtois getting the ball? Ref decided he was, goal was chalked off. Now, ultimately, the correct decision was made, but if VAR is going to be used, and I'm increasingly not a fan, you know, constantly flip-flopping on it, increasingly not a fan, but I think being against VAR now is like being against electricity. It's here and it's here to stay. Then they're going to have to do something with the offside law, because that is ridiculous. If it takes the referee, this whole process took nearly 3 minutes, by the way.
2 minutes, 50 seconds, exactly.
The crowd had no idea what was going on. It became evident after the game. The players didn't know what was going on because Thibaut Courtois was interviewed and he thought the goal had been disallowed for something else. You know, so nobody knows what's going on. And if you're so barely offside that, the ref has to basically get a ruler out before arriving at his decision, then, and VAR is going to be used, then the offside law needs to be changed. I think there's a problem with that. But ultimately, it was the correct decision, but it just ruined that period of the game, because it took too long, and the crowd who were there, and they've paid good money to be there, they hadn't a clue what was happening.
First goal disallowed by VAR in the Champions League.
Pathetic. I just say, I find it absolutely pathetic. I'm actually scandalised by it. There's no offside. The idea there's a toe offside is fucking ridiculous. And the fact is, what is he supposed to do exactly? What is the player who finds himself then in offside position and interfering with play? What is he supposed to do? He makes no movement whatsoever, right, towards Courtois. He's just there. He can't move. Courtois flaps at the ball, misses it. You look at his sheepish expression after the goal, because it is a goal.
Yeah.
And he knows perfectly well the goal should stand.
Yeah, but hang on. I mean, look,
it just annoys me.
Yes, but if it was clear and obvious,
yeah. It was not clear and not obvious.
If he was
clear
too
and obvious doesn't apply to offside decisions. Yeah. That's the problem.
Well, was the goal choked off for offside then? That's a cop-out.
Well, it was offside.
Laws Lars arrives.
I mean,
there is such a thing as the spirit of the law, and the spirit of the law is not respected in this particular case, and it really, really annoys me.
Danny Baker posted an interesting tweet after this last night. He said, cameras should be there to tell us what's happening, not to decide what's happening.
Very
and I agree
well
with him.
Put.
Well, in this case, they told the ref what happened, and he decided what the call was. I mean, for what might be a first in my life, I do actually disagree with you, Philippe. I do think the player makes a movement towards the goalkeeper. If you see on the slow motion, he is blocking him off a little bit. My problem with this is that, as I think I've said before in the tweet on the pod, football is a low-scoring game, and your team scoring a goal is I don't know what your job is and what your life's like, but it's probably one of the best things to happen to you that week, like if you're a proper football fan. It's this sort of extraordinary sort of release of tension and just an eruption of joy. And the fact that you now have something that potentially sullies it a little bit because you have to wait and see if it was really a goal or not, that feels like a very high price for me to pay, even if the result is that you get more fair decisions. We got a tweet, I think, from Sam Rubiek, and I'm going to read it out because I think it's very well worded. Is the real tragedy of VAR that for every goal ever scored, our ecstasy is, to some greater or lesser degree, dulled by the uncertainty of whether the technology will allow it? That's too big a price to pay for a few more so-called correct calls. I'm still on the fence about whether VAR is a good thing or a bad thing. I suspect it doesn't matter what I think, but I completely sympathize with the people who feel that that interruption in what should be a pure moment of happiness is against the spirit of the game.
I kind of agree with Barry about this toe offside seeming just not enough. However, if that isn't the line, what is the line?
It's not up to me to decide what the line is.
Yeah, but
the line is in the wrong place.
Okay, well, where would you put it? I mean, it might not be up to you.
I don't know. I'd have to have a good think about it.
Okay.
But because, I would imagine it's a workable decision.
Well, if there's half a body,
solution.
Full body?
I don't know.
Okay.
You can keep asking me. I don't know, but it's not...
to get like that.
It's not for me...
Is it one of those...
To decide.
Is it one of those situations where you know it's actually... deeply wrong, but you can't really put your finger on why it is absolutely wrong.
I know what you mean. I think we're all agreed a toe doesn't seem right, but if it's not a toe...
Is it offensive of me to suggest that if this had happened down the other end and it was Sergio Ramos blocking off the Ajax goalkeeper, we probably wouldn't mind whatever...
But it's Sergio Ramos. It's completely different.
Just saying.
Ramos, by the way, was one yellow card away from a suspension, so... In the last minute of the game, he decided, I'll clean the slate. Took out, was it Frankie de Jong or someone with a quite obvious, hey ref, yellow card me please, thanks, suspended for the
second kicking
leg.
The ball away would be the easiest way to get a dodgy yellow. How good was Vinicius Jr.?
I was very impressed with him. Nobody in a Real Madrid shirt excelled themselves in the first half, but he was instrumental in their first goal, you know, searing run. He's got unbelievable pace. Down the touchline, cut inside, and set up the goal for Benzema. So I was impressed, but Real Madrid didn't play particularly well last night.
A word on Benzema, because it was his 60th goal in the Champions League, which now makes him the fourth most prolific scorer in the history of the competition, behind Ronaldo, Messi and Raul Gonzalez Blanco. Not exactly bad company for a player who is still seen by some as not quite cutting it.
Yeah, it was some finish, wasn't it?
And him stepping it up the last couple of weeks is part of why Real Madrid are suddenly quite good again.
Absolutely.
Now, isn't it? I mean, he's really... maybe Real Madrid would have hoped that this would happen straight from the off the season, but he certainly now seems to be taking the responsibility they were hoping he would when Ronaldo left.
Roma 2, Porto 1. Adrian Lopez scored a pretty fluky late goal to give Porto hope after Nicolò Zaniolo's first Champions League goals for Roma. Edin Dzeko vital in both goals. Zaniolo's only 19, Lars, isn't he?
He is, and he was very highly rated at the sort of youth team at Inter. But still, him being put into the Nainggolan deal was a bit of a left field thing. I understand Roma were insistent on having him in there, but I have an acquaintance who's a big Roma fan and a very savvy guy who publicly speculated that this might be some sort of unsavory accounting going on there, because it was such an out there transfer and he was supposedly valued at 10 million euros or something, which seemed weird at the time for a guy who hadn't really played. But you're seeing him now, of course, there's so much promise there. And important for Roma, this whole Monchi project. There's a bit of a bad feeling there. It seems like Monchi has looked at it and think, okay, Roma financially can't compete with the best in Europe, so we have to kind of do a Spurs and just try to sign young players who can potentially become very good. And I think for a lot of Roma fans, that doesn't sit right. They feel like they're Roma. There shouldn't be some sort of high-powered Udinese. That's not what their club is meant to be. But so for them, then, having a guy who actually comes through and looks exciting, at least that gives you the sort of feel-good thing of seeing a young player come through, which is great fun.
One game in the Premier League on Monday. Wolves 1, Newcastle 1. the fuming Benitez sort of marching around the pitch, just muttering to himself. I'm surprised I haven't seen someone put subtitles of lots of different things to Rafa marching around there. He was very angry because Willy Bolly scored in the 5th minute of the minimum 4 minutes of injury time, cancelling out Isaac Hayes' opener. Rafa says, and it was a, he went up with Dubravka. I don't think it was a foul, personally. I thought Dubravka was pretty poor in that situation. Rafa says, in England, they don't understand the rules. I can say many things, but it will not change anything. I didn't like the challenge at the end. You have to protect the keeper. We've been here for years, and it's still very difficult to explain that. Second time they've conceded against Wolves in the last minute this season. Mac Doherty scored a 94th minute winner at St James's earlier in the season. But it was a mistake. Rafa's wrong here, isn't it? And as Jackie Oatley, Wolves fan Jackie Oatley, pointed out, Rafa upset. The goal was scored 34 seconds over the minimum of 4 minutes added time, but he made a substitution in stoppage time, which took about a minute.
Yep.
Do we have any sympathy for Rafa Benitez?
Well, you have sympathy for Rafa Benitez, of course, because I always have sympathy for Rafa Benitez anyway, so I can't see why this should be different. It's just frustration speaking, which is, you can understand. You see the position of the club at the moment. You know, they're still not out of it. So I think it was just frustration speaking. You know, you can forgive that. It's just a purely human reaction. Even if, objectively speaking, I don't think he had anything to complain about.
In the Championship, Leeds returned to the top with a 2-1 win over Swansea. Pontus Janssen, Jack Harrison with the goals. That's because Norwich slipped up to a surprise 3-1 defeat at Preston.
Very strange.
Very strange, exactly right. Third place, Sheffield United. Anyone could beat anyone. Toughest league in the world.
Most unpredictable, certainly.
Yes. Third place, Sheffield United closed the gap on the Canaries with a 1-0 win over Middlesbrough. On Tuesday, the FA have charged Dwight Gayle with an alleged act of simulation. Not that alleged. I'm gonna stick my neck out there. It was really late on. Earned them a point because Jay Rodriguez scored the penalty. He got a lot of height, to be fair to Gayle. From one angle, it did look like a penalty. From the other, definitely didn't. Big win for second bottom Bolton. 1-0 at Birmingham. Their first away win since August. Fair play to the Bolton fans who've been going to every away game. And lots of fun at Millwall 0, Sheffield Wednesday 0. The ref, clearly a hard line, non-away kit man, made them both play in their home kits. At touchline, it apparently looked okay. So the dark blue of Millwall with the blue and white stripes of Wednesday. But Wednesday's kit on the back is, I think it's all blue. So the stripes are on the front. So the crowd really had trouble identifying who was who. And both managers were slightly confused. Steve Bruce saying, I had a yellow kit in the back, you know, like a Sunday league manager. Which one should we use? But, you know, I'm a big fan of refs going, why don't we just have no away kits in football?
Is it the ref's decision?
I believe so, yeah. So, you know, when Liverpool play Manchester United, tough. Both in red, let's see what happens. Leeds Real Madrid would be good, wouldn't it? Absolutely not a clue. I'm fully in favour of this. Right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll find out if Barry is sad about Declan Rice. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Barry, are you sad about Declan Rice?
Not really. I'm certainly not as sad as football's nice man, Kevin Kilbane, who's getting very, very agitated about it indeed and seems to have thrown the rattle out of the pram altogether.
I should probably explain the story, if you don't know. He submitted a written request to FIFA to transfer his registration from the Republic of Ireland to England, ending quite a long-running saga over his international allegiance. He was born in Kingston-upon-Thames. His paternal grandparents are from Cork. He played for Ireland at junior level, made 3 senior caps, all in friendly fixtures, permitting him to declare for the country of his birth. He did a very well worded statement, whether he wrote it or he probably had, you know, whether his people wrote it. He basically said, look, I'm really proud of both and I have mixed heritage and that's a difficult position to be in and I've declared for England. I've spoken to Mick McCarthy, Martin O'Neill, to Gareth Southgate.
It was a very impressive statement and very humble as well. I wish he declared for Ireland, but he hasn't. And I find it quite funny. He's getting a bit of grief on the internet, but, you know, he's a young man with the world at his feet. I'm sure he won't be too bothered about what a few anonymous numpties on Twitter have to say about it. It's kind of disappointing, but, you know, good luck to him.
Yeah, I mean, he did say in the statement, look, I'm not presuming I'm going to get picked by Gareth Southgate. Do you presume he is going to get picked in the next squad?
Oh, yeah.
He's a, I studied, you know, sometimes you're watching, you watch a game and you take time to really focus on a player. In the Liverpool game, I did that with Declan Rice.
Yes.
And I didn't, not David Squire's mind blown, but I was very impressed.
I think everybody has been very impressed with him, and not just in that game. So, yeah, he seems to have real quality and qualities which are missing in most other English midfielders at the moment. Mm. So could he be, you know, the final, not the final piece in the puzzle, but certainly one which is going to make the puzzle look a bit more complete? I think most people who've been watching him with West Ham would agree that he's a very special player indeed.
I just hope he made the decision that it was his decision and that he wasn't being nudged in that direction by agents who are...
By a beef eater.
who have their eye on, you know, he would make a lot more money as an England international than he would as an Ireland international.
True.
Yeah, it's possible to be cynical about it, and maybe that is the correct approach in some ways, but I tend to think if you're not someone who has a dual nationality yourself or any sort of experience of having a foot in two different countries and cultures, maybe hold off on having too strong an opinion on this. There's a good chance you don't know what you're talking about.
Are you declaring yourself available for Ireland?
No.
Lars? Okay.
Well, a lot of Irish people find it unthinkable that you could, you know, be proud of your Irish heritage and proud of your English heritage. You know, how could you be proud of being English? But, you know, I've spent almost half my life in England. I like it. I have a lot of time for England and English people. So, and I don't have any familial links. And the fact of the matter is, he's going to win fuck all whoever he declares. So it doesn't really matter.
Who's your favourite Englishman, Barry?
My favourite Englishman... Oh, you're waving.
That's just, I'm just saying hi.
I don't really have a favourite. I love all Englishmen. Okay, that's great. Going to endear me.
Blackpool have been put into receivership so the club can be sold and the proceeds used to pay off some of the £22 million owed by their owners, the Oyston family, to the Latvian banker Valery Belokon. A court's ordered this. English Football League rules state that if a club suffer an insolvency event, which includes the appointment of a receiver, they receive a 12-point deduction. The league has not yet determined whether that penalty will be imposed in this case. But this could be the beginning of the Oystons not owning Blackpool. And
it seems it is the beginning, yes, absolutely.
So this is the beginning of them not being there, which we can all agree is a good thing.
I'd imagine most Blackpool fans would happily take a 12-point deduction to get rid of them.
Yeah. Take 24-point deduction, go down two divisions as long as they can get rid of those guys.
Absolutely. FA Cup fifth round this weekend.
Apparently, by the way, a debt is negotiable.
Right.
So apparently, you know, it wouldn't take £22 million to get the club.
Okay.
You know, you can always, sometimes you pay 30p in the pound. It depends. I mean, they're, with the creditors, there have to be an arrangement. And there's a possibility that Blackpool could, you know, with the right support, become a community-owned club.
Which would be great,
which would be wonderful.
FA Cup fifth round, there is just one game on Saturday at 3pm.
Game's gone,
Brian. Friday, QPR Watford. Saturday, Brighton Derby's early. AFC Millwall is the 3 o'clock. Newport Manchester City is...
the one we're all looking forward to.
That's got to be great.
Isn't it? I mean, the weather, sadly, I think it might be picking up. What we really
want...
But it's, I don't
so
know.
So bad.
But just the thought of Manchester City, their coach, their Death Star turning up at Rodney Parade, which, you know, for people who may not know, is actually a provincial rugby ground where Newport Gwent Dragons play. It's owned by the Welsh Rugby Football Union. When Newport played Middlesbrough, you could see the look of horror on the Middlesbrough players' faces when they arrived. Lashing rain, pitch an absolute quagmire, and they were beaten before they even got, you know, togged out in the dressing room.
12 degrees and sunny on Saturday.
That's a shame.
That is a great shame, isn't it? Bristol City Wolves on early kickoff on Sunday, then Doncaster Palace, Swansea Brentford at 4 o'clock, and then Chelsea Man United on Monday, which we can look ahead to on the next pod. Interesting story that Martin Skrtel turned down Barcelona in January. Did anyone know this?
No.
Which Barcelona? Oh, there's several teams in Barcelona.
The Barcelona, apparently.
What?
According to Midhat Halis, partner in the company that represents Martin Skrtel, Barcelona tried to sign the Fenerbahce centre-half in the January transfer market.
Ah.
But he turned them down.
I can't think of any reasons why a partner in the company who represents Martin Skrtel would want to tell the press such a thing.
Why are you so cynical?
It might be true, though. I mean, maybe they went for the Kevin Prince Boateng Martin Skrtel double whammy in January and could only get one of them.
Ex-Crystal Palace midfielder Jordan Mutch has joined the South Korean side Gyeongnam FC. Here is a great photo of him.
So Gyeongnam looking style. Confused.
Yes, exactly. Gyeongnam style. Him doing a thumbs up with the mascot. It's not as good as Mascot's Minute Silence. But it is still quite a tremendous picture.
I quite like this. He had a stint in MLS as well. And I think, you know, if I was a footballer at some sort of level and I had the chance to sort of see the world in that manner, I'd go for it. Why not? It's great.
Now, in the photo, they've all got their fists clenched. And someone tweeted, they're all doing that pose. The two owners, Jordan Mutch and the mascot, which is a sort of a bird or a duck of some sort. Someone on Twitter said that's because their nickname is the Fisters, which is patently untrue, but lots of tabloids picked that up anyway. So it's just quite funny, isn't it?
Would they ever have been managed by Otto Fister?
Or Wally Fister?
I don't know either of those people.
Wally Fister is a famous cinematographer.
Yes, whereas Otto Fister is a sort of old German coach who's been in charge of many national teams around the world.
Aaron Ramsey to Juventus has been formally announced. 400,000 a week, apparently. What do we think? It's going down by the day, isn't it?
Yeah, we think that it's a little bit of an overestimation, perhaps by as much as 100%, as in maybe 200, 250. But still, it's not 400.
It's sad for Arsenal fans, isn't it? Because of how he's playing now. No?
I don't know about that. People will regret the fact that there is no body who seems to be able to do what he does well, which is, you know, be in the box at the right time, score some important goals, the FA Cup final and so forth. But he hasn't been the most consistent of players throughout his Arsenal career. He's been at Arsenal for something like a decade, and he's never quite got to the level people were expecting of him. And in a way, sort of nice, lovely player, scorer of some great goals, but a little bit too comfortable, perhaps. And I think for many Arsenal fans, he would almost be the personification of some of the things which didn't quite right in the last 10 years of Wenger's regime, which is a nice team, playing very well, technically very adept and so forth, with some great moments, but lacking this little je ne sais quoi. In fact, I know exactly where it is, a little bit perhaps of, I don't know, you know what I mean? Sort of
the je ne sais quoi.
Sort of fist-like quality.
Okay.
A fist.
He's not a fister.
There's actually an energy drink called Fist.
Is there?
Quite pungent.
I'm worried about where this pod is descending to.
I think people, Arsenal fans, would be more, they would be more worried about the fact that there doesn't seem to be a ready replacement for him and Ozil in that kind of role, and that the team lacks a creative presence in midfield. That is something. And also, it will leave with everybody's goodwill, because he's been a good servant of the club. And honestly, his behaviour, since he decided to go to Juventus, has been absolutely superb.
Very fair point.
I do think, if you had put a gun to, which you shouldn't do, if you put a gun to Unai Emery's head and you told him, here's Mesut Ozil, here's Aaron Ramsey, you're going to lose one of these guys on a free, whereas the other one's going to get a massive contract that's going to be a bit of a millstone around the club for the next couple of years, I think he would probably rather keep Ramsey. I think that's fair to say. But at the same time, as much as fans shouldn't have to be accountants, one of my mantras, I do understand why, from an Arsenal fan's perspective, Ramsey's 28. Like Philippe has so eloquently said, he's never quite put it all together. He's been quite a lot of injured. The club is in a brilliant state financially. You can understand anything upwards of 200 grand a week. Like, you can see why the club wouldn't want to do that.
We did have a number of tweets the last time you said football fans shouldn't be accountants, from accountants saying, I'm both a football fan and an accountant. Do I have to give up one of the two?
No, my father is a football fan and an accountant. That's fine. My point is that this obsession about
Understanding the business.
Yes.
I understand that. Right.
It's nice that fans take an interest and they want their clubs to be run healthily. I'm all in favour of that. But also, it is about winning things and having fun as well.
Just a note on Jurgen Klopp. He's been charged by the FA for comments made about Kevin Friend, the ref, after the West Ham draw. He intimated after the 1-1 draw that Friend's performance had been affected by the assistant referee's mistake for Sadio Mane's goal.
Is this the first incident of a manager having to explain himself for complaining about a decision that went his team's way?
Possibly.
I mean, this is taking it to a whole new level. He complained. He was ultimately complaining about the ref awarding Liverpool a goal.
An FA statement read, Jurgen Klopp has today been charged with a breach of FA rule. Which one, Lars? Come on, you know them all.
What?
Which rule?
Law.
Which law has he been charged with breaching?
Well, I zoned out there for a moment.
E3, come on, Lars. Obviously, rule E3. It is alleged that comments he made in a post-match interview following Liverpool's league game against West Ham on the 4th of February 2019 breached rule E3 brackets 1, as they questioned the integrity of the match referee and or implied bias. On Monday's pod, I can't remember who mentioned people who listened to this but didn't like sport, and we were wondering if anybody listened to this pod who didn't like football. Thank you to Chris and Steve. Chris says, I've never liked football. I don't support a team. I got into the pod over the World Cup and stayed, despite often being utterly baffled as to what you're on about. Am I alone? And Steve says, I've never been a sports fan, but I started listening during the World Cup. I had trouble sleeping in September, so I started listening again because all the meaningless chatter about things I didn't care about by cheerful and dour voices was quite pleasantly boring. Unfortunately, over time, the various plot lines became less and less meaningless, and I grudgingly became a football fan. Now I have to watch actual games to fall asleep, which on a good night are still uneventful enough to do the trick. Thank you, Steve and Chris. Thank you to everyone who doesn't like football and to everyone who does. Thanks to you, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.